So here's the question number one tonight. What is the ultimate goal of walking meditation? Being here. That's the ultimate goal. Because you don't get anywhere. You start from one end, you go to the other end, and then you come back again. It's just like life. What's the ultimate goal of life? It's learning how to be here instead of going somewhere. But when you look at life anyway, where you start out is where you end up. What are those two old people? They were talking to each other and one was said, "Oh, I'm 80 years of age now. Oh, it's terrible. Everything aches. I feel awful." And his friend said, he's asked his friend, "How do you feel?" And his friend said, "Oh, I feel like a newborn baby. But you're about the same age as me, about 80. How can you feel like a newborn baby?" "Well," he said, "I've got no hair, I've got no teeth, and I've just wet my pants." Which shows you that where you start is where you finish. Just like walking meditation. So that's the whole idea, is being here and finding out what here is like instead of going somewhere. It's also in order to get peaceful. Because if you do the walking meditation properly, I never actually said that when you do walking meditation, you should gaze about 2 meters in front of you. Don't close your eyes. Otherwise, you'll bang into the wall or fall over somebody else. And if you don't look around, if you look around, you're comparing yourself with others. Just 2 meters in front, it gives you the sense of security that you're not going to fall over anything. So 2 meters in front, just walk backwards, turn around and walk back again. It's excellent for Singapore people. You're always doing something. You're doing something to get something out of it. And now, at last, you're doing something which is totally useless. You're just walking back and then walking one way, walking back again. And I can't help but just telling all these stories. That when the monks first went to England, and they moved into this place in Chidhurst, in Sussex, it was an old house. And one of the supporters was a psychiatrist who worked at the local hospital for people with mental disorders. But being a psychiatrist, she was quite well paid. So she managed to get this old house, like a manor house, in one of these English villages. And because it was a manor house with stables, there were many places where they could put up people to meditate. So many of the retreatants were in the stables. So don't complain about your accommodation. And of course they were doing sitting, but it was only for a weekend, one of the first meditation retreats they did. Only doing walking meditation and sitting meditation on the weekend. And so when it came to walking meditation, all the people were walking in the garden of this house in an English village, walking very slowly, mindful of the left step rising, going forward, pushing down. Next step rising, going forward, going down. Looking 2 feet, two meters in front, walking very slow, then turning round and coming back again. Now I think you all know the English. They always like to look through the windows to see what was going on. And they knew that the owner of that house was a psychiatrist who worked in the local institute for the mentally disabled. And when they saw all these people walking very slowly, they thought, "Oh my goodness, her patients have come home." And they called the police. And the police came in a couple of cars to take these people back to the hospital. And it took a long time to explain that these were meditators, not crazy people. And that actually happened. Fortunately, the police understood and let them carry on walking slowly. But they really thought they were crazy people she brought back from the hospital for the weekend. But it's also, you do that because if you sit down to meditate too long, you get very sore. So you sit down, meditate, get quite peaceful, and then when the body gets sore, that's why we built the rooms right next to the meditation hall. So you don't have to go very far. You just get up and go into one of the rooms and do your walking, and then when you've carried on walking, you come back to sit, and then you walk. Doesn't matter how long, you make it according to your needs, and that way you can keep the meditation going. You know, it's continuous. So that means you can get very, very peaceful and very still. So that's the purpose of having these meditation walking rooms right next to the sitting room, which means that there's hardly any transition. So that means you take this stillness and you keep it, and it gets more and more and more still till you get very still. And that's cool. So that's what we do with the walking meditation. Dear Ajahn, does counting help in meditation? Most of the time I lost count and my mind wanders a bit. During your early days when you learn meditation, do you use this method? Do you find it helpful? If you like doing maths, then you can do the counting. Because many of you love maths, you're accountants and you like tallying things up. So yeah, you can do it, but some of you just can't do maths. So having to count things really sucks, it's really more difficulty. So some people, when they do the counting meditation, they have to use a calculator. But if you really want to do counting meditation, it's not bad at the beginning, but it's quite forceful. And the way I learned how to do this, many, many, many ways. Actually, the way which I was doing for a while, but now I experimented with it. I don't really like it because it was far too forceful. I'd breathe in one, in two, out two, in three, out three, up to nine, in nine, out nine. Then I start again, in one, in two, out two, up to eight, and then in one, in two, out two, up to seven, and then in one, up to six, in one, in two, out two, in three, out three, in four, out five to five, and then down to four, in one, in two, out two, in three, out three, in four. And then to three, in one, in two, out two, in three, out three. Then in one, in two, out two. Then in one, to one. And you had to be quite mindful to do something like that. It was actually 45 breaths. You have to watch each one of them. You know what happened though? Sometimes it was in 13, out 13, in 14. You totally lost it. You just carry on counting like you do. And so what I did every time I lost my place, I didn't know where I was, I started again at the beginning until I could do one whole cycle. That took a lot of effort. But at least you were watching the breath. It gave you something to do. So if you're really bored in this retreat, try that. See if you can do one cycle. In, one, in, two, out, two, in, three, out, three. It's a bit of fun, but at least you're focusing on the breath. But don't do it too much, otherwise you just get too tense. The other way of doing it, which was very useful also, but instead of counting that way, we just breathe in a very long breath, but comfortable. And try and count to nine. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine. And as you breathe out, nine, eight, seven, six, four, five, three, two, one. And do that for a couple of minutes. And then just shorten it a bit to maybe six. One, two, three, four, five, six, six, five, four, three, two, one. Because what that was doing, he was actually having all this counting within just one in-breath or within one out-breath. So it never gave you a chance to have any thinking. You're just too busy counting all the time. And so because of that, you actually managed to get rid of all these thoughts. And once all the thoughts were gone, you forget the counting and you just carry on just watching the breath without counting. So you can use counting, but it's just a little support before you can watch the breath without needing to count. So you can do that if you wish. It's a bit of fun. It gives you a little bit of variety. Because the problem is, many of you, until you get into the beautiful, delightful breath, the meditation can be a bit boring. Just, you know, sitting here and just making peace, being kind, being gentle, making bloody peace, kind, gentle. Gee. How long do I have to do this for? So it's nice to actually to make it a bit more interesting, so we play around a bit. In the same way, I gave you one mantra, you know, the breathing in, shut, breathing out, up, which is good fun. But I didn't teach you with the walking meditation, which is one wonderful thing to do, is instead of saying Buddha with the walking meditation, as your left foot moves, you say to yourself, I will die. As your right foot moves, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. If in Bahasa, mati pasti. Mati pasti. That's right, isn't it? In Bahasa? Yes, that's very nice. Mati pasti. Mati pasti. Fatais, die. Nah. Die. Nah. Die. Nah. Because what that does, you know, it does grab your attention. And also, first of all, you think it's a joke. You're going, I will die, that's for sure. Yeah, it's a joke. Ajahn Brahm's being funny again. But after a while, you realize, hang on, this is true. And then you get scared. But carry on, because you're walking. Don't stop. When you get scared, keep on walking. Walk through that fear. I will die, that's for sure. Don't run away, carry on. Because what happens when you get through that fear? So what? I will die, that's for sure. What's wrong with that? And in fact, what it does, all those thoughts which you have lose all their value. All your worries and concerns just fade away. I'm going to die, so what? I don't have to worry about anything. I don't have to worry about this monastery or this retreat center. I'm going to die. Yeah! I don't have to worry about my debts. Yeah, someone else has to pay that. I'm dead. My husband, my wife, my kids, and all these problems. When you're alive, you have lots of problems. When you're dead, you rest in peace. So it's actually very freeing. So usually what happens if you practice that, first of all, you think it's a joke. Then you start getting afraid. Then you get really afraid. You keep walking until you realize it's okay to die. And then you lose a lot of attachments. You just, they fade away. And then you have this wonderful state, sense of peace. You're walking like dead man walking. And it's easy, and you're free, because you've got no worries at all. Isn't that wonderful? So that's another way to make the walking meditation fun. If you're very tired, because sometimes you get up in the morning, and you know it's just boredom, then you can walk backwards. Because if you walk backwards, you soon become very aware when you hit your head on the wall. Or if you want to try the Australian way of walking meditation, you put your hands like this and you hop, and you hop, and you hop. That's called kangaroo walking meditation. I taught that last time. A few people tried that. So what does it do if you do that? It brings you happiness, joy, energy. You don't get so bored. So if you really are bored, wondering what to do next, because you're really miserable, do kangaroo walking meditation. And you find you'll bring a smile to everybody else in that room.
That's your compassion for them. So that's how you can make it interesting. Venerable Sir, is it all right to follow up metta bhavana after breathing meditation? Can you briefly elaborate on metta bhavana and its benefits? This is metta bhavana, making peace, being kind, being gentle. Now, what I'm saying here, what your object of meditation is not important. Because of that, you know that sometimes people come up to me. This is one of the old stories, but it's important to know. They come up to me and said, teach me meditation. So I teach them breath meditation. And after a while, they found I can't do that. So then I teach them anapanasati. And if they can't do anapanasati, then I teach them loving kindness meditation. And if they can't do loving kindness, have trouble, then I teach them metta bhavana. If they can't do metta bhavana, then I teach them insight. When they have trouble with insight, then I teach them vipassana. And if they can't do vipassana, then I teach them breath meditation. By that time, they've forgotten where they started. And as you should all know, anapanasati is breath meditation. You know, metta is sort of a loving kindness. So these are all the same. So people say, I do vipassana, and I do metta bhavana. They're exactly the same. We just give them different names to make them more interesting. And it's not whether you're doing vipassana or metta or watching your breath. It is how you are doing this is the core of meditation. If you're doing vipassana, are you trying hard to get something, to get insight? If you're doing samatha, are you holding your body really still? Are you controlling? Are you making peace? Are you being kind? Are you being gentle? If you're not, I don't care what you're doing, that's not meditation. So if you're doing metta, may all beings be happy and well, or else. That's not metta. Or may all beings be happy and well, except that person who snores every morning. That's not better, is it? So you've got to be very careful. So what you do is, like, whatever you're doing, you have kindness. Open the door of your heart to every moment. Whether you're doing metta bhavana and you fall asleep and you get angry at yourself, that's not metta bhavana. Open the door of your heart to the person, the beautiful person who snores every morning. Please, may you snore all week. You're wonderful, you're most welcome. Open the door of your heart to the person that keeps banging the door in your cottage. That's metta bhavana. Making peace with the noise. Being very gentle in your, not just your speech, but in your thoughts to all beings. So whether you're restless or whether you're sleepy, whether you're seeing these beautiful lights in the mind, or you're just watching a breath, or you're just walking, I will die, that's for sure. Make peace with these things. Be kind, open the door of your heart to the meditation practice, to this moment, and be gentle. And all the things happen. And I'll explain tomorrow, because tomorrow somebody asked me about, you know, how to progress in meditation. I said, you don't progress, you ingress. You go into things, you don't go on to the next stage. So if you do metta bhavana, you don't follow on with anything. If you do breath meditation, you don't follow on with insight. You don't follow on with anything. You follow in. And I'll teach you that tomorrow with the story of the 1,000-petal lotus. It's the best simile which I've got for this. And it'll answer that question. It's a very profound simile. Because it also shows where people go wrong in meditation and how meditation actually works. Bhante, how does one know that one has become a stream enterer? Thank you. You know when you don't ask questions like this. Oh. You're peaceful. If there is no self, who faces the karma vipaka? Where do we store our bank of unwholesome and unwholesome deeds? Thank you, Bhante.
If you really understand and penetrate this no self, yeah, then you're free of the karma. It's called ahosi karma, karma that was. But you've got to fully know that first of all. Because you believe or assume or perceive that you're in here, then you're going to get the karma. It's what you perceive and how you look and how you regard things. So everybody, all the Buddhists know there's no self. But if I call you a stupid pig, what do you mean, stupid pig? See, you've got a self. So if someone can call you the biggest, stupidest idiot in the whole of Singapore, and you don't react at all, maybe you haven't got a self, and then you don't have any karma. So because you assume there's a self, because you think, because you regard there's somebody in here, who decided to come on this retreat? Was it you? Why did you come? Who decided to write this question? Did you have any choice? If you thought it was you, if you think you're in control, then there's a self, and then there's karma. So it's great when there's no self, and then you realize that, you're free. You can crack bad jokes, and you don't get any bad karmic response results from that. Okay, I was just telling this bad joke. Who was it to somebody on the telephone? Oh yeah, this lady in. She's a bit down because she's just gone to the dentist, had 5 teeth out. So I told her a joke and it was very painful when she laughed. I'm a very cruel monk. You know that story of the cat which died? No. You know the cats have 9 lives?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, but this cat got hit by a truck with 10 wheels. Boom, 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 boom. 1, 2, 3, 4. Isn't that a bad joke for a Buddhist monk to say? But there's no self in here, so I don't get any karma. Okay, where do we store our bank of unwholesome and unwholesome deeds? In your illusion bank. Dear Ajahn, so Ajahn Chah said, it's not the noise disturbs you, but you disturb the noise. But isn't noise also said to be the thorn or obstacle to jhana? Is this why, for example, your disciples put in soundproofing when building your cave? Could you please explain how these two statements relate and how one is to practice with sounds? How did forest monks in Thailand manage to get into jhanas with all the sounds in the tropical jungle? Can one get into jhanas practicing meditation in a condo on a busy street in Singapore? Okay. When you've been watching the movies, or maybe the cricket, the soccer, have ever you told your husband when he's busy watching the soccer, darling, you know, there's a telephone call, and he hasn't heard you? Many times that happens. There's that story of the Malaysian couple here in Perth. And they were watching a movie. It was a wonderful movie, because when they finished, one of them went up to go to the toilet, and the other one went up to make a cup of tea. And only when they got up off the sofa did they look behind them and saw many valuable things were missing. And they soon realized a burglar had been in their house, this is a true story, and had stolen things right behind the sofa where they were sitting watching the TV. They hadn't heard a thing, because they were watching the movie, and they couldn't hear anything. If only you could do that when you were meditating. What happens? Somebody comes in and goes out, and said they're disturbing you. They turn the kettle on in the cottage, and it disturbs you. But if you're watching a movie, nothing will disturb you. Or if you're checking your emails on your mobile phone, nothing will disturb you. Now you understand what it means. If you really are focused and interesting, the noise doesn't disturb you.
Why does noise grab your attention? It's because you go out. What are they saying? Who's doing that? That's really why the noise disturbs you. It's none of your business. So this is actually why it is us which disturb the noise. We go out to find out who it is, who did that, what the noise is, rather than just letting the noise go. So after a while, I say, none of my business. You know, whoever wants to bang the door, whoever wants to turn on the kettle at 1 a.m. in the morning, it's their business, not mine. Because if they bang the door, it's gone in a second. But if you keep thinking, they bang the door, I'm going to tell Ajahn Brahm, they're going to be banned, blacklist them from the retreats. We're going to actually kick them out of the Buddhist fellowship as well. You know, they can't bang the door like that. That's really insensitive. And at 1 o'clock in the morning, they should go to bed early. They don't consider me. I've got to have my beauty sleep. And you find out that the door finished banging a long time ago and it's still echoing in your mind. And the greatest noise is not the noise of the door, but the noise of you thinking and moaning and complaining about it. That's the biggest noise. So yeah, they turn on the kettle in the cottage. That's soon gone. But the anger and the thoughts inside your mind, that's the noise you should be concerned about. You can't stop people making noises, but you can stop yourself reacting to them. So don't disturb the noise. And then your tree. And that's actually how you get into these jhanas. Oh, it's just noise, it's noise, nothing to do with me. Because you pay no attention to it, because it's not important, you don't give it value, like I was saying this morning, it vanishes. Whatever you give value to occupies your mind. So if that's important for you, it will occupy your mind. If it's none of my business, it's trivial stuff, then you're not disturbing the noise. And that's how you get into deep meditation. Once you get into deep meditation, noise can't affect you. That's why sometimes people get into deep meditation and you tell them, time for lunch. They can't hear you. They're having a good time. Which is wonderful when that happens. So what was that story? Okay. The story of the guy here in Perth who he would meditate maybe half an hour, 45 minutes at most. And one Sunday afternoon, he told his wife, I'm going to meditate in my bedroom just for a short time. After an hour and a half or 2 hours, he hadn't come out from his room. So his wife went to see what he was doing. And there he was, sitting perfectly still. Very still. Too still. He wasn't even breathing. Oh my God, she thought. My husband's dead. So she rang in Perth, it's 000, not 999. So please, if anyone dies here, don't ring 999. No one will come. 000. In 5 minutes, the ambulance came. With loud noise. And the medics, they rushed into the house. And they put his pulse. No pulse. The fellow looked like he was dead. So they put him into the gurney, the trolley, wheeled him to the ambulance, had all the machines on him there and everything else. And his wife was there with him, rushing to the hospital, going through all the red lights, making a lot of noise, swerving around the bends, going as fast as they could. It was a matter of life and death. When they got to the hospital, straight into the emergency room, and all the nurses going on, putting this on and that on and everything else on. They put on the ECG. It was flat. Ding, 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 emergency. Doctors tell me it doesn't go ding, ding, ding. But who cares? I don't let the truth spoil a good story. Ding, 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 ding. Emergency, it's a flat line. And they also put an EEG on.
to see if there was any brain activity. Another flat line. He was dead. Usually, they told me, they would take such a person straight down to the morgue with the other corpses. He was very lucky they did not take him down to the morgue, because later on when he came out of meditation, all those attendants working in the morgue would have probably died of a heart attack. And the only reason was because they had an Indian doctor on duty that weekend. And he knew, because he heard, that sometimes yogis in deep meditation can suspend all their life activities. So he gave him a chance. Because his wife said he was meditating. So they put on defibrillators, these electric currents which shock you and make you rise up off the trolley. Many times they tried to stimulate his heart to work. Nothing worked. Flat lines. Ding, 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 ding. Until he decided to come out of his meditation. He just opened his eyes. He leant up. So where am I? I was in my bedroom. What am I doing here? Beep, beep, beep. All the monitors were perfect. And the doctor, this is true story, they gave him a quick checkup, nothing wrong with him at all. Heart, everything was perfect. They didn't even keep him in overnight. He said, go home, and he walked home with his wife. Now that is called deep meditation. That's jhana realms. And you're perfectly safe. I won't allow them to take you to the morgue. I know what's happening. You're just very still. But the thing is, there it was, the sound of all those sirens and people rushing around. He didn't hear a thing. He was perfectly happy, blissed out inside. And he came out when he wanted to come out. Now that's what we mean by the sound can't disturb you. That's cool. The time of his life. Don't be afraid, because that's a beautiful, wonderful experience. Wouldn't have given that up for the world. Dear Ajahn, is the unconscious that happens when we fall asleep the same unconsciousness that happens when we nirvana? No, otherwise it'd be very easy to go to nirvana. Just take sleeping tablets. In nirvana you don't dream, nor in nirvana you don't snore. Does the Noble Eightfold Path exist in any other religions aside from Buddhism? For example, can Christian mystics or Sufi masters who meditate be enlightened? There are some non-Buddhist religious leaders who certainly seem very wise and very compassionate. That's a good question, because that relates to one of the last questions asked of the Buddha from the wanderer Subhadra just before the Buddha passed away. He asked him the same, are there any enlightened beings in other religions? And the Buddha gave a beautiful answer. He said, wherever there is the Eightfold Path, there you will find enlightened beings. Doesn't matter what you call it. You call it Buddhism, Christianity, Islam, or whatever you call it. It's what you do, not what you call yourself. That's why there are many people who are Buddhists. They don't follow the Eightfold Path, so they'll never get enlightened. So it's what you do. If you follow the path, this is where it leads to enlightenment. So, you know, there are some people, they may call themselves Christians, but they're more Buddhist than many Buddhists are, because they're practicing the Eightfold Path. So it's what you do, not what you believe. So some people say, Theravada, Mahayana, or Vajrayana, which is the best path? It doesn't matter, it's what you do. So if you're like a Hinayana, but you're practicing the Eightfold Path, brilliant. If you're Mahayana, you're practicing the Eightfold Path, brilliant, you're going to get enlightened.
Even if you make bodhisattva vows, I'm not going to put off my enlightenment. But if you practice the Eightfold Path, I'm sorry, it's going to happen. It's not up to you. It's non-self, okay? So because of that, I always wanted to try and bring all those three major traditions together. Some of you haven't heard this before. Most of you probably have. So to put all the traditions together, you take the H from Hinayana, the Aha from Mahayana, and the Yana from Vajrayana, the three great traditions, and you put it together. And what does that spell? Hahayana. And that is my path. The Hahayana. And if you're laughing, you're also Hahayana. Dear Ajahn, thank you for answering my question the other day. I can live frugally in Singapore, but what about the people in Somalia? What can we do for them? You know, when I was in Thailand, the first a young monk, there were all these really dirt poor people in northeast Thailand. I mean, they were really poor. All they had was, you know, some rice to eat and some fish, you know, and other soft stuff to eat. Sometimes they would eat things which crawl on the ground or leaves from the trees. But they were so happy. I've never seen people that happy in London or in Cambridge, where all these rich, wealthy people live. And so sometimes I thought, my goodness, I've been sending all this money over to these poor places, and I'm the one who's suffering, not these guys. And sometimes I realize that some of these poor countries, you know what they did to Thailand? You know, they put electricity into all these villages, healthcare, hospitals. And I always remember this old Thai man, he said, people weren't sick in the old days, but once they built the hospital, people started to become sick. And that was very interesting, what he was actually saying there. All this development, is it making a better world? Or is there something we've lost? The beautiful simplicity. Families. One of my memories from that time, the first year I was in northeast Thailand, was going to some celebration in the evening in the village to do some chanting. And as we walked through the village, there was no electricity. So you'd see in the houses in the village, they were all on stumps, on like posts. Underneath were the water buffalo. And they had little rooms like in a semicircle. And then there was an open area. And that's where we saw by a oil lamp. To make the oil lamp, they would take the top of a toothpaste tube and they would get a rag and push it through and float it on some kerosene. So simple but very effective. It was smoky, which kept away the mosquitoes, but gave them light to see. And I'd see the whole family sitting around this one single light. You could see the faces of the grandparents and the uncles and the parents and the kids, maybe about 15, 16 people, from the young kids to the old grandparents. And you see them sitting around talking to each other, telling stories, maybe the same old stories like I tell here. But they were telling them together and they were laughing and happy. Every evening they would do that. And I thought, my goodness, I really lost out in my upbringing. We'd sit around watching a TV and argue. There was only two channels in those days. We would argue to death over which channel. So sometimes in a simple life, sometimes we've missed something in our complicated life. Living frugally means we have time and time together. Sometimes we're so developed, we've lost some important parts of life. In Somalia, they may be dirt poor, but they have something which you've lost in Singapore. Fascinating, isn't it? What is real wealth? What is poverty? Please tell us what the most important qualities for living harmoniously in community with others. Easily, don't talk. It's true, because look, there was some years ago, there was this couple who came to our monastery. She was Thai, he was Australian. She could only speak Thai, she couldn't speak any word of Australian at all, no English. He could only speak English, he couldn't understand any Thai. So they couldn't understand what each other was saying, and they lived so happily together. Wouldn't that be wonderful? You don't know what your husband is saying or what your wife's up to. So you don't get upset. She may be calling you a terrible name, but you don't understand because you can't understand what she's speaking. That way you can be peaceful. So number one, to live harmoniously, be careful of your speech. But the biggest trick of living harmoniously with other people, and I keep saying this to every time someone gets married. A couple of people here are going to get married soon, so I gave them this trick too. I said, once you're married, you must never think of yourself. And they all agree, when you're married, you can't think of yourself. And then I say, when you're married, looking at the guy, once you're married, you must never think of her, your wife. I love the look on their face because they get confused and they're worrying that this monk is a crazy guy. And then I look at her and I say, once you're married, you must never think of your husband. This is called teaching through confusion. It's like a riddle you've got to find the answer to. And of course the answer is, when you're married, you must never think of yourself, you must never think of your partner, you must only think of us. And that's totally different. If you think of yourself, that's selfish. That's in Buddhism, Hinayana. If you think of your partner, that's Mahayana. You're sacrificing yourself, you get burnt out after a while. That's not the secret of harmony, just, again, the doormat and just giving, 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 giving. You know, like a bodhisattva, you just die out of nothing left in it for you. But when you think of us, that's the third option, which most people miss out on. It's being married, it's not about me or you, it's about us. So the secret of harmony is all about us in a family. Grandparents, parents, children. It's not about me or you, it's all about us. In a company. It's not about the boss or the workers, it's about us. That's what a company means. And the same with a Buddhist fellowship. It's not about ex-co. It's not about just the people who are working or the people who clean the toilets, which are always closest to the Buddha. It's all about us. We work together. And that's the secret of harmony. When that's the most important thing, then whose problem is it in a marriage? Is it her problem? Oh, you, Ajahn Brahm, you should understand what she's like. She's very sweet when she comes in front of you, but when she's in front of me, she's not like that at all. It's her problem. And I talk to her and say, it's his problem. It's not. In a marriage, whose problem is it? Our problem, yes. If you blame your partner or blame yourself, there's no solution. So, in the Buddhist fellowship, is it the president's problem? Is it this terrible person on the ex-co who's causing problems? Problem? Is it the spiritual patron's problem? No, it is our problem. So you sit around and you solve it together. And that's the secret of harmony. Dear Ajahn, I was doing walking meditation. After a while, the ground beneath me started to look like a big forest with beautiful streams, waterfalls and streams.
Do you think I'm going nuts? Confession, I had some nuts today. No, that's good fun. Actually, that could be a very good sign, because when you start to get very still and peaceful, your mindfulness gets very strong. When it gets very strong, you can see the beauty in simple things. Can I say that? Because that happened to me when I was in Thailand. I was walking on concrete. And I, you know, concrete is the most boring thing. People put, you know, some carpet or some wood on top of the concrete. It could make it look nice, but hard concrete, grey concrete. I was walking backwards and forwards. My peace, my stillness was very strong, and it got to that point I had to stop. Because the concrete I was looking at, all the different shades of grey, and the contours, because it had texture to it, and it just opened up to me, and it was the most beautiful piece of concrete I've ever seen in my whole life. Simply because my mindfulness got very strong, and even the piece of concrete took on like this landscape. And I stopped and stared at that for about half an hour. I couldn't take my attention away. It was absolutely gorgeous. That is natural. That is what happens when you get into stillness. You look at the mat there and you can see streams, you can see, and it's beautiful. All it is your mind is expanding. And it's seeing things there, seeing beauty, and this is the way you interpret the beauty. If that happens, just enjoy it to the max. It doesn't last. And then go and sit meditation, have a very deep meditation afterwards. It's just how we can free our perception and see beautiful things. So well done. You're not going nuts. You're getting into good meditation. I've been teaching meditation for so many years. I've never had one person go nuts yet. And I don't intend to ruin my reputation on this retreat. So you're fine. Dear Ajahn, how does sitting quietly help me to see the truth more than what I already know by listening to your talks and reading Dhamma books? You've been listening to my talks such a long time. If you knew the truth, you wouldn't have to read my books again. You could write your own. So remember, listening to talks and reading books, that is just the same as the story, another story is coming, of the professor of philosophy in NUS in Singapore. The very famous professor of philosophy also was a gourmet. He loved his food. So when he heard that in Singapore, a chef from France was opening up a 5-star Michelin-rated restaurant in Orchard Road, straight away, he called that restaurant to make a reservation. And the person who answered the phone said, "We're booked out for 2 months." Nevertheless, he said, "Put my name down. I don't mind waiting." 2 months went past. He went to that restaurant. They checked his ID to make sure that it was who he said he was. And when they found he had a reservation, the maitre d' led him inside. A 5-star restaurant is the top niche restaurant. So you can understand how expensive the food was and just how tasteful was all the interior decoration. Whoever designed that was a genius. Just the colors, the light, the beautiful mahogany tables. It was perfect. And when he went to his table, he sat down. And a few minutes later, the waiter came with the menu. And the waiter was dressed like an English butler. Perfectly poised and so genteel as he handed the professor the menu. And the menu itself, thick card, gold lettering, like a work of art you'd expect to see in the National Museum
rather than in a restaurant. And the professor thanked the waiter for the menu. And the professor then proceeded to eat the menu. And having finished chewing the last piece of the menu, he got up, paid his bill, and left. Because professors do not know the difference between the words and the food. That's why you should be still rather than reading my books. You've eaten all my books. You've chewed all those talks. But don't do that. Cook the food and taste the food, for goodness sake. Taste stillness rather than read about it. Dear Ajahn, do monks and nuns who renounce a worldly life ever feel restless about that being able to continue taking care of their loved ones? How should one deal with such a restless mind? Is there a sense of guilt? No, this is the best way you can take care of your loved ones, by getting out of the way. Because a lot of time, you're a pain in the neck to your loved ones. So when you get rid of them, they're so free. Wouldn't you? Can't you imagine one of your relations you'd like to get rid of? You can't kill them because that's against your precepts, but you can take them to a monastery and ordain them. And then I have to look after them, thank you very much. There is one of our monks over in Bodhinyana Monastery. He's not sort of Ajahn Pamali, another monk. When he became a monk here, his family really objected. They didn't like it one bit. Because you're wasting your life. You should be looking after us instead of just going off and searching for the meaning of life like some selfish, good-for-nothing layabout. But anyway, he became a monk and then his father died. So as soon as his father died, he went over to visit his family. And I remember them showing the letter from his mother. Yeah, thank you, you must come over. We'll have a suit waiting for you at the airport. We don't want you to wear your robe. We're embarrassed. Wear proper clothes. And so he showed me that. I said, no. Tell your parents, or your mum, and your brothers, it's either these robes or nothing. Naked. Make your choice. So, of course, they chose the robes. And because this was a very difficult time for the family, the father had died, he organized everything, spoke at the funeral service, and he was so impressive that the elder brother wrote me a letter saying, we don't know what you've been doing to our brother, but please carry on. He's a wonderful man. Now we realize how important that training is. He's changed so much, and he was such a strength to us. We really respect him now being a monk. Please train him forever. And it's just what happened. Because he'd been a monk, then he could really serve his family. So it's not being guilty because you're going away from your family. You are building up the resources so when your family really needs you, you can help them. And they feel so grateful there's a monk or a nun there who can really serve them like no one else can, especially in the difficult times. And anyway, who are your loved ones? I'm taking care of all of my loved ones. Some people say, oh, Ajahn Brahm, don't you miss having children? So you are all my children. So you're my loved ones. So I don't feel restless. I look after you. Tell you jokes, teach you how to meditate. Arrange so you can have congee in the morning. So you don't get hungry. According to Prime Minister Lee, if Singaporeans are contented, Singapore will go downhill. It's nice going downhill. It's very peaceful down the bottom. Can a Buddhist be materialistic, materially wealthy? Of course you can be wealthy. But you know, a lot of people don't know what to do with wealth. That is why many, many experiments and surveys have been done. What is the optimum income? Because if you get too much money, it is a big pain. You've got to worry how to invest it. And it's very difficult investing money these days. People say this is a sure investment and it fails. So you have lots and lots of worries when you've got excess money. So people know too much money is suffering. You have to work hard, you can't relax. If you're too poor, it's a lot of suffering. You can't afford it, you can't pay your bills, there's a lot of worries as well. So they realize there must be some maximum, the best income, where you haven't got too much, haven't got too little, the old middle way. And that middle way income, they realize that is the happiness. They prove that psychologically, too much is suffering, too little is suffering. And they worked out, it's about 5 or 6 years ago, in the United States, it was about $50,000 or $60,000 US a year. Less than that, you just can't afford the basic necessities. You can't enjoy yourself. You can't go overseas on holidays. More than that, you just got too many worries. It'd probably be about the same. Maybe a few years ago, maybe say 80,000, 90,000. I'm not sure in Singapore because it's expensive. So if you're earning less than that, you can have a lot of suffering. More than that, you can have suffering. So look, if any of you are earning more than that, I can help you become happier. There's a donation box around the corner. You'll be happier, guaranteed. I've tried that many times. No one puts any money in the box. But it is true, sometimes too much wealth. It's materials wealth. So a lot of economies now are looking at not the gross national product, which is gross, but the subtle national product, you know, the well-being and happiness of people. And that really is the hill we should be climbing in Singapore or the rest of the world. Not just the material wealth, but just how much happiness you have, the time you have for yourself, the lack of mental illnesses like depression, or other stress-related illnesses like cancer. I just remember once going into this Singapore General Hospital. I was visiting someone with cancer, and I was walking past ward after ward after ward after ward with people with cancer. So many people. To me, that said there's something wrong. Because most people understand that cancer is a stress-related illness. So is that development? Working people so hard that it fills the hospitals with cancer patients? If that is going uphill, I'd prefer to be down the bottom of the hill. So anyway, it's good to sort of to work hard. If you are wealthy, fine. But if wealth is given to you because of your karma, because of your hard work, it's not really hard work. You have to work hard, but some people work even harder than you and they still don't make wealth. But if you are wealthy, then use it wisely. And wisely, I mean, they say in Buddhism the four parts, you know, one part for your family, you know, one part for your happiness and enjoyment, one investment for the future, and the other one for charity. I don't mean 25%. I mean just, you know, apportion it. If you do that, that's the best use of wealth. And if you use your wealth wisely, you don't just use it for yourself. Use it for your family, for business, society, charity. If you use it wisely, you make the good karma, you get wealth in your next life. If you don't know how to use it, you just waste it. Then you won't get wealth next time. It's as if wealth is entrusted to people who know how it should be used, according to karma. Dear Ajahn, oh no, it doesn't say that, it says your nothingness. Thank you. Could you kindly explain merit sharing? How should it be done? We have heard 2 to 3 versions. Now you're going to hear version number 4. Merit sharing. First of all, to do merit sharing, you have to make some merit. That is the most important. And how do you make merit? It's not just putting ang pao's in the box. No. It's being kind to one another. It's making merit. It's sacrificing your morning meditation to make porridge for everybody else. That's making merit. It's being kind, giving, sharing. It is realizing that some people have a hard time, so if they bang the doors, you forgive them. That's making merit. It's being kind to everybody. And if they're talking too much, you don't go and hit them and tell them off and go and tell me. No, that's not making merit. Be kind. Have a peaceful heart and give people the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they're just going through a difficult time. So let them do what they need to do. That's called making merit. Making peace, being kind, being gentle. And once you've made that merit, already you're sharing it with others. The very fact you're a peaceful, kind person. You're a wonderful person to have in the cottage. Just by who you are, you're already sharing merits with the people you live with. As for me, I'm sharing merits every time I look at you, smile, tell a joke, tell some dhamma. That's how I'm sharing merits with me. All the merits which I've made, I'm giving to you so you can be peaceful, happy as well. That's the best way to share merits. You be kind, you be wise, and then you can share it with others. Even if you're not a teacher, just who you are, you will affect so many people in your life. That is the fourth and best way of sharing merits. Dear Ajahn, right over left, white, right leg over left leg, right palm over left palm. The answer is why not? I don't know, it's just a story. But that also is the last question for tonight. So please have a nice rest tonight, because tomorrow is the full moon. And when the full moon is so much energy around, you may not feel like sleeping so much. So have a good rest tonight to prepare yourself for the final push towards jhanas and enlightenment. It's true, you know, most people get enlightened under the full moon. And you've got the good karma to be in Jhana Grove on one of the most holy full moon nights of the year, the Pawamana full moon. So have a rest tonight and prepare yourself. Tomorrow something big might happen. Probably not, but it's worthwhile. Okay, so sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.